Good morning, everyone. It's wonderful to see the number of folks that we've got here. I love the fact that we had to go get more of the Lord's Supper. That's a wonderful sign that always happened to you. Those of you who are expecting to see and hear Wayne Galloway, if you would allow me to quote a line from one of my favorite movies, get used to disappointment. You're stuck with me this morning. I'm very sorry that we had to postpone that meeting with Wayne. I was very much looking forward to the week-long series. The topic that he was going to be talking about was the family as God intended it to be. And that's a very important and exciting subject for us, and I hope we will be able to reschedule that soon. Ever since I've been with this congregation, just for the few short months that I've been here, I've always wanted to be helpful. I've always wanted to jump in and see what I can do to help. But I also have learned a lesson that when you jump in with both feet into something that you don't really know very well, you tend to make a mess of it. And so what I've tried to do is observe. I've just tried to listen, tried to keep my mouth shut as much as possible, and to look around and to learn. And I can tell you that one of the observations that I've had about this congregation, there's a lot of really good people here. A lot of really good people who really want to serve their Lord, but they're not sure how. This is a congregation that lacks leadership. I think most of you recognize that. This congregation doesn't have elders. I am fully convinced that God intends for every local church to have elders. I believe that everybody would share that thought with me. I'm also convinced that God provides the way for us to do everything that he wants us to do. And so I'm convinced that with God's help, this congregation can have elders and can have them soon. I don't think that's something we should be looking down the road. Someday we're going to do that. Someday never comes. I think we all recognize that. And so this lesson is a lesson that I had never preached before up until last month. I never preached it in Paris, never preached it in any other place that I have preached before. The title of the lesson is, How Big Is Your God? And the subtitle is, He's Not Big Enough. And I said not till last month. I had the lesson already done, and when I was asked to preach in Winchester last month, I went ahead and preached that sermon there just to kind of tune it up and prepare it. The picture that I've got on the screen here, I want us to represent two young boys that are talking together, and they're talking about their dads. And as they're talking about their dads, they're talking about what their dad can do. My dad can do this, and my dad can do that. And of course, they're one-upping each other. And by the end of the conversation, Superman would be embarrassed to be around those dads. He would just feel completely inadequate. And that's a really good thing. It's a good thing that young boys look up to their dad and think they can do anything. What about your dad? And I'm not talking about biology now. I'm talking about spiritually. What about your father? What can he do? Can he do anything? Can he do everything? What does our God look like in our mind? How big is your God? And then as I said, and I don't mean this to be insulting, he's not big enough. My God is not big enough. The point of our lesson is for our God to grow larger in our minds this morning. We're going to talk a little bit about the power of God this morning. Let me make sure I did this right. We're going to talk, first of all, about what kind of power our God has. Then we're going to talk about what that would mean for us. And then finally, I think the most important part of any lesson is, what is the practical application? How do I put that to use in my life? Genesis chapter 1 has long been my favorite chapter in all the Bible. I believe that the most important verse in the Bible is Genesis chapter 1 and verse 1. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. It's a relatively short verse. There's many verses that have many more words in them, but I would say none of them have more power. What that tells us is that our God created everything that is. And then as you continue to study in Genesis chapter 1, you find that God did that simply by speaking. We think of people, magicians, might have a magic wand or some sort of power. God just did it by speaking. And then when that world was filled with evil, Genesis chapter 6 tells us that the thoughts of men's heart were evil continuously. Have you ever thought that maybe Moses was really talking about our world? Do we not find that this world is full of evil? We find this world is full of people who are thinking and trying to do evil to us or other people. And we think, what can I do? What can anybody do to fix that? Well, God did. He cleaned that world of all of its evil. That shows the power of the God, our God. And that same God could take one man who was nearly 100 years old, his wife who was nearly 90 years old, never had any children at all, and make of them a great nation. A nation that would change this world. He promised him, he says, for Sarah, your wife, you'll not call her Sarai anymore, but Sarah will be her name, and I will bless her. And moreover, I will give you a son by her. And I will bless her. She shall become nations. Kings of peoples shall come from her. Then Abraham fell on his face and laughed and said to himself, notice Sarah's not the only one who laughed at that. Abraham also laughed at this idea. Shall a child be born to a man who's 100 years old? Shall Sarah, who is 90 years old, bear a child? And then that great nation went to Egypt and became numerous people, but not a great nation. Instead, they were slaves. They were being held captive by the most powerful nation on earth. They were serving to build powerful, great cities and temples. Many of the archaeological sites that we hear about or have read about, maybe some of you have seen in Egypt, might have been constructed by those Hebrew slaves. And then God could take those people that had no God, had no land, had no national identity, had no leader, and they were under the thumb of the most powerful nation of the world, and could deliver them, and not only deliver them, make them wealthy by their masters. And then God could take a little shepherd boy, a young man, almost certainly in his teens, too young to serve in the army, and he could take that shepherd boy and bring him to the great battle scene where the Philistines and the Israelites are ready to battle. And a giant of a man, larger than any man we know of today, you think of Shaquille O'Neal or somebody like that, this man dwarfed him. He was a trained soldier. He frightened every single Israelite in the army, including David's older brothers and the king. And yet the shepherd boy said, well, I will fight against it. Now, what does all of that mean? And of course, we could all pick many, many stories from both the Old and the New Testament that would emphasize the point I'm making. What does all of that mean to see a God who could do all of those things? It means our God is able. And you say, what do you mean? Able to do what? I'm not putting anything on the end of that, because whatever it is, our God is able. He is able to do anything and everything. In that story of David fighting against the giant, he had gone to the king, a king who towered over David. Remember, Saul was head and shoulders above every man. The people wanted him as their king so he could fight their battles for them. And I find it interesting that Saul was in the tent in the back line while the other soldiers are on the front line. David's been brought back to the king's tent. And he said, I want to go fight against him. And Saul tells him, well, you can't. You can't win. Another movie line. He says, he's been fighting from the time he's a youth. He's a well-trained soldier. You are but just a young boy. David said to him, your servant used to keep sheep for his father. And when there came a lion or a bear and took a lamb from the flock, I went after him and struck him and delivered it out of his mouth. And as he if he arose against me, I caught him by the beard and I struck him and killed him. He says, your servant has struck down both lions, that's in plural, bears, plural, And this uncircumcised Philistine will be like one of them, for he has defied the armies of the living God. And David said, the Lord who delivered me, who is able, who delivered me from the paw of the lion and from the paw of the bear, will deliver me from the hand of this Philistine. And Saul said to David, go and the Lord be with you. I wonder whether Saul shared the confidence of David or not. But I want you to see the confidence that David had in his God. David did not try to convince Saul that I'm a great warrior. He tried to convince Saul that God is a great God. And he says, I will win because of God. One of my favorite verses in the book of Ephesians, I've preached a couple of sermons from this last verse here in chapter 3. Now to him who is able to do far more abundantly than what we ask or think. One more movie line. In the original Star Wars, I remember at one point Luke Skywalker was promising to Han Solo that the princess would give him great riches. And he said, well, how much? And of course, Luke's just making up stuff. And he says, well, more than you can imagine. And he said, I don't know. I can imagine much. Well, that's what Paul promised to us. God can do more abundantly or far more abundantly than all we ask or think. Whatever you think God can do, he can do more. Not only can he do more, he can do abundantly more. Not only can he do abundantly more, he can do far more abundantly more than you ask or think. How big is your God? He's not big enough. My God's not big enough. I can't think or imagine what my God can do. And then Paul says, to him be the glory in the church throughout all generations, forever and ever. Secondly, it means that I can trust my God. I can have confidence in my God. I can have faith in my God. I so appreciate the songs that Adam picked out for our lesson this morning, the prayer that Nate led at the beginning of our service, because that's exactly along the lines that I was thinking, that I'm planning for this lesson. It means I can trust God. The reading that we had there from Hebrews chapter 11, the writer just said, what else can I say? And he listed names that we recognize or maybe not recognize from the Old Testament. But all of them were people who lived by faith and died by faith. Notice it says that some of them were delivered from the mouth of lions. David, we've already talked about him. Daniel, of course, was another one, delivered from the mouth of lions. They quenched the power of fire, they escaped the edge of the sword, made strong out of weakness, became mighty in war, put foreign armies to flight, women received back their dead by resurrection. Some were tortured, refusing to accept their release so they might rise again to a better life. Others suffered mocking. Now it's starting to get closer to home. I've never had a lion challenge me because of my faith in the Lord. I've never had the edge of a sword stuck to my neck because of my faith in my Lord. But you know what? I have been mocked. And I suspect everybody else here who walks for Christ has been mocked because of that. Flogged, chains, imprisonment. We're not that far from it. They were stoned. They were sawn in two. They were killed with the sword. Wait a minute. Didn't you say your God is able to deliver any of us? Well, absolutely. Remember the words of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in the book of Daniel? King Nebuchadnezzar is telling them in his fury, if you do not bow down and worship my God, you will be thrown into this furnace of fire. And they told him, our God is able to deliver us. We don't know whether he will or not. But whether he does or does not deliver us, our faith, our trust will be in him. Some of these people who lived by faith died because of their faith. But their faith was not forgotten. Their faith was not ignored. That's what this writer is trying to get us to understand. Whether it turns out good for us in this life or whether it turns out bad for us in this life, it still is a faith that is rewarded because we have put our confidence and trust in a big God. A God who must be bigger. The last two verses in that chapter said, all these, though commended through their faith, did not receive what was promised. When you think of Abraham and the promises that were made to him, that he was going to be made into a great nation, that they were going to have this land as a possession, that in him all the nations of the earth would be blessed. How many of those blessings did Abraham see in his lifetime? The only land that he owned was a cave that he had to buy for his wife to be buried in. The great nation might have been 20 or 30 people by the time that Abraham died. He never saw the promised one to come until Jesus said, Abraham was happy to see me. None of those things happened before Abraham died. Was his faith a failure? Of course not. His faith an example to all of us because his God was big. And even then, still not big enough. What it means is that we are on the winning side. Those of you who like to play games, some of you know already that I like to play games. When I play games, I play to win. That doesn't mean I'm a bad loser. I don't care who wins after it's over, but I play to win. God is telling us that he is on the winning side. Imagine we were to randomly take 9 people here today, and we divide them up to play pickup basketball, 5 on one side, 4 on the other. I'm not going to tell you the names. Who do you think is going to win? Well, most of you think probably the team that's got 5. Oh, I forgot to tell you that Shaquille O'Neal is going to be on that other team. Now who's going to win? Well, now we all know. Whatever team, it could be 9-on-1. And whoever's got Shaquille O'Neal or LeBron James or whoever you want to pick, they're going to win. That's what we have to understand about this battle. God is on our side. And if God is on our side, I don't care who's on the other side, we're going to win. We have already won. In the book of Revelation, we read Revelation chapter 17. We read about a dragon and 2 great beasts. And I want you to understand that God, in showing this vision to John, was very careful about how he shows this vision. He is not trying to show that the enemies of God's people are weak and insignificant. He doesn't say it's, you know, 2 midgets and a mouse fighting against God's people. It is a great dragon and it is 2 great beasts that by themselves, any one of them was frightening and fearful. All 3 together causes us all to fear. And yet it says they will make war against the Lamb. Here's a dragon and 2 beasts fighting against the Lamb, and the Lamb will conquer them. For he is Lord of lords and King of kings, and with him are the called and the chosen and the faithful. In chapter 19, the beast and the kings of the earth with their armies gathered to make war against him who was sitting on the horse and against his army. The beast was captured. With it, the false prophet who in the presence had done signs by which he deceived those who received the mark of the beast and those who worshipped its image. The 2 were thrown alive into the lake of fire that burns with sulfur. The rest were slain by the sword that comes out of the mouth of the one sitting on the horse. And all the birds were gorged with their flesh. Romans chapter 8, what then shall we say to these things? If God is for us, who can be against us? Well, there's a whole lot of people that are arrayed against us. We recognize that there are the intellectuals, there are the powerful, there are the wealthy. As Paul says in the book of 1 Corinthians, the things that are in this world are arrayed against those who have not. And yet what Paul is telling us right here is, we have nothing to fear from that. He says, who shall bring any charge against God's elect? It is God who justifies. Who is to condemn? Christ Jesus is the one who died. More than that, who is raised, who is at the right hand of God, who indeed is interceding for us. What shall separate us from the love of Christ? Imagine a young child out in public, maybe for the first time after they're able to walk. And they kind of want to go around and explore and see, but then there's a lot of people. And they turn and they run back to their mother or their father and grab them around the leg. Any of you with children can remember what I'm talking about or see it happen now? That's what we need to understand about our God. Our God is so big and powerful that all those things in this world that frighten and scare us, what we need to do is run back and grab hold of our God. Knowing all these things, we are more than conquerors through Him who loved us. We don't just barely win. It's not even a competition. We are more than conquerors. For I am sure that neither death, nor life, nor angels, nor rulers, nor things that are present, nor things to come, nor powers, nor height, nor depth, nor any other created thing, not anything else in creation, will be able to separate us from the love of God in Christ Jesus our Lord. How big is your God? He's still not big enough. So what does that mean for me? What's the application that I make in my life? Here's the part of the lesson I changed for today. Are you fearful of this virus that's so small that none of us can see it? Are you fearful of things that are so large that they're overwhelming to us? And please let me make a point here that I'll try to make a couple of more times as I go through the remainder of the lesson. In no way am I diminishing the dangers that we face. I'm thankful about some of the changes that we have made in our services that are trying to alleviate the potential of infecting each other. I think they're smart and prudent for us to take. But I'm not going to let that cause me to completely panic and fear and not serve my Lord. In the book of Acts, we read at near the end of the third mission journey of the Apostle Paul, as he was returning back to Jerusalem with a large sum of money that he had collected to bring for the needy saints there in Jerusalem. And he'd come fairly close to Jerusalem. I believe this is Antioch or Caesarea. I don't remember exactly where, but one of those cities along the coastline. And since we were staying there for many days, a prophet named Agabus came from Judea. And coming to us, he took Paul's belt, and he bound his own feet in his hands. Thus saith the Holy Spirit, this is how the Jews at Jerusalem will bind the man who owns this belt and deliver him into the hands of the Gentiles. Understand, this is a prophet of God, and he's delivering a message of God. And this message of God was the fact that the one who owned the belt, Paul, would be bound hand and foot by the Jews and be delivered into the hands of the Romans. Understandably so, when this prophecy was given, Luke says, when we heard this, we and the people there urged him not to go to Jerusalem. Don't go, Paul. There's lots of other places that you can go and you can be useful in God's kingdom. Then Paul answered, what are you doing, weeping and breaking my heart? There were a lot of tears. There was a lot of emotion, a lot of anguish in that discussion. He says, for I am ready not only to be imprisoned, but even to die in Jerusalem for the name of the Lord Jesus. And since he would not be persuaded, we ended and said, let the will of the Lord be done. Again, I do not want to diminish the dangers. The fact is that I may be infected with that virus. I may die from it. One of my loved ones may die from it. I don't look forward to that. I hope it doesn't happen. I hope it doesn't happen to anybody that we know. But it could happen. But I'm ready to die for the cause of my Lord. Do you feel unqualified to talk to people about Christ? A number of times I've heard people tell me, I'm just not sure that I'm going to say the right thing. I'm afraid that maybe I'll say something that will cause someone else to turn their back on the Lord. And then they would never, ever come to Christ. And I could never live with that guilt or burden in my life, knowing that I said the wrong thing. Do you think God will let that happen? A God that could arrange for the shepherd boy to kill a giant. A God that could arrange for a man who was not very good with his tongue to deliver his people from the Egyptians. That was Moses' argument. Moses said to the Lord, "Lord, I'm not eloquent, either in the past or in the present." He said, "I am slow of speech and of tongue." And the Lord said to him, "Who has made man's mouth? Who made your mouth, Moses? Who gave you your ability to speak? Who makes him mute or deaf or seeing or blind? Is it not I, the Lord? Now therefore go, and I will be with your mouth and teach you what to speak." My God is big enough that if I'm talking to someone about the gospel, God's not going to let me ruin it. He's not going to let me be the reason why they will never come to his kingdom. We need to recognize how big our God truly is. And then realize he's still not big enough. The fact is, our God used a donkey to teach a selfish prophet. We all remember the story of Balaam, how that Balaam was traveling to go and curse the Israelites, and his donkey just sat down at one point. And Balaam is beating the donkey, and the donkey says, "What have I done to you?" At this point, I'm falling off the donkey. I don't know what was wrong with Balaam, but I had just fallen off the donkey, and it starts talking to me. But he gets in an argument with the donkey because God was teaching him a lesson. If God can use a donkey, he can use you, he can use me. More practical example is where we find a couple, Priscilla and Aquila. They were serving the Lord, and this very powerful, eloquent man, a man named Apollos, came and was preaching the message of God, but he didn't know the whole truth. He didn't know about Jesus. And again, remember, he's described as being powerful in the scriptures and an eloquent speaker. How many times you thought, well, you know, they're just too good a speaker. They're just going to burn me up. They're just going to tie me in knots and I'm going to lose this argument. Priscilla and Aquila took Apollos aside and explained to him the way of God more accurately. Our God makes us able to do amazing things. Are you discouraged? Depressed? Maybe depressed because of the virus. Maybe discouraged because of things happening in your life. Illnesses or heartache within your family or difficulties in the job. I don't know what all the reasons why. And again, I don't want to diminish the idea. Depression is a very real thing. It's a very serious thing. But again, I have to ask the question, how big is your God? Job was a very powerful, wise, faithful man. And yet Job was faced with some very intense difficulties in his life. And the most common question Job asked is why? And he didn't get an answer. Job asked, "Why did I not die at birth? Just come out from the womb and expire. Why did the knees receive me? Why the breast that I should nurse? Why is light given to him who is in misery and life to the bitter of the soul who long for death and it comes not? Dig for it more than hidden treasure who rejoice exceedingly and glad when they find the grave." Here's a man who wants to die. How many different ways can he tell us? He wants to die. And God won't let him die. And God won't tell him why. How big is your God? The interesting thing about Job is when we get to the end of the book, I'm not talking about chapter 42, I'm talking about chapter 37 or 38. When God comes to Job and finally starts to talk to him, Job's answer is not why this happened. Instead, what God does is tell him how big he is. And then keeps telling him how big he is. And then tells him some more how big he is. And Job stops asking to die. And that's all before God did anything about his suffering. But what he needed to know, what all of us need to know, is how big our God is. Elijah was a prophet of God, a great prophet of God, because we know since he was invited to be at the transfiguration of Jesus. Moses and Elijah are the two characters. They're called from the Old Testament time to be there with Christ to tie this story together. And yet Elijah was ready to give up. He had gone into the wilderness 40 days journey. And he came and he sat down under a broom tree. He asked that he might die. He says, "It is enough, O Lord. Take my life. I'm no better than my father's." After God has shown him how big he is, again, he says, "What are you doing here, Elijah? I've been very zealous for the Lord, the God of my host. For the people of Israel have forsaken your covenant. They've thrown down your altars. They've killed your prophets with the sword. And I, even I alone, am left. And they seek my life to take it away." Do you feel alone in your service to the Lord? That's one of Satan's most powerful tools, is to make us think that we are alone. Jesus got frustrated. He got frustrated with his disciples. "Teacher, I brought my son to you, for he has spent a spirit that makes him mute. Whenever it seizes him, it throws him down. He foams and grinds his teeth, and he becomes rigid. I asked your disciples to cast it out, and they were not able." He answered them, "O faithless generation, how long am I to be with you? How long am I to bear with you?" How many times did you find Jesus saying, "O you of little faith, bring him to me"? They brought the boy, and when the spirit saw him, immediately convulsed the boy. He fell on the ground, rolled around, foaming at the mouth. Jesus asked the father, "How long has this been happening?" He says, "From the time he was a child. It's cast him into the fire, into the water, often trying to destroy him. But if you can do anything..." Did you catch that? Jesus did. "If you can do anything..." I wish the Bible came with punctuation. I'm just convinced that Jesus roared those words. "If you can, all things are possible for him who believes." How big is your God? Still not big enough. Are the obstacles too great for us? Do we feel like it's impossible to appoint elders to rule us and lead us? Do we feel like it's impossible to be able to reach out to the lost and for this congregation to grow by bringing other people into the kingdom of Christ? Do we feel like that sometimes our children are just too far gone? We never can bring them back. Do we feel like our country is spiraling down the drain and nothing can restore it back to what it should be? Our culture is irreparably broken. All of those things might be frightening you, discouraging you, frustrating you, getting you to the point where you just think it can't be done. One of the things I appreciate about Adam's study in the book of Leviticus and Numbers was something I noticed in Numbers chapter 11. Unfortunately, he was at a point there where he was trying to really get through the book. But this is something that struck me as I was reading. When Moses had the problem of the people complaining about meat, God tells him, "Consecrate yourselves for tomorrow, for you will eat meat. You have wept in the hearing of the Lord, saying, 'Who will give us meat to eat? It is better for us in Egypt.' The Lord is going to give you meat, and you will eat. You will not eat one day. You will not eat 2 days. You will not eat 5 days. You will not eat 10 days or 20 days. God says, "You're going to eat meat every day for a whole month, and you're so sick of it that all you can do is smell meat." And Moses turned to God. He says, What? How are we going to take care of that?" He says, "There's 600,000 men on foot. We don't have enough flocks. We could gather all the fish in the Mediterranean Sea, and it still wouldn't be enough to feed all of these people." And look at what God said to Moses. Is the Lord's hand shortened? You will know whether my word will come true for you or not. It doesn't surprise us that the people of Israel did the same thing. We can't. We can't. We can't. And God says, I can. And you'll see that I can. Finally, King Asa. King Asa was one of the good kings of Judah. If you go down, look at that chart, the kings of Judah, Israel and Judah, you'll see Asa's got a smiley face, so we know he was a good king. He was a reformer king. His father had been wicked before him, but Asa had reformed the people of Judah and had brought them back to the God, and then they were invaded. They were invaded by an Ethiopian army that numbered more than 1 million men. It was frightening. I can't even imagine what that would have been like for Asa to draw up his army that was less than 600,000 men. And across the battlefield, there's over 1 million men. There's 300 chariots, which were the equivalent of the tanks of the day. Israel doesn't have any of those. And Asa recognizes this is not going to go well. And so Asa looked to God. Oh, Lord, there is none like you to help between the mighty and the weak. They're the mighty, we're the weak. I want you to understand that. Help us, O Lord our God, for we rely on in you. And in your name we have come against this multitude, O Lord. You are our God. Let not man prevail against you. So the Lord defeated the Ethiopians before Asa, before Judah, and the Ethiopians fled. That was near the beginning of Asa's reign. He reigned for 36 years. He became wealthy. He became mighty. Because God was with him. And then near the end of Asa's reign, the king of Israel, Baasha, a wicked king, he had a frown. So he was a wicked king. And he went up against Judah. And Asa was frightened. And so Asa, because he was frightened, stripped the treasures out of the temple and out of his own palace. And he sent them to the king of Syria, Ben-Hadad. And he told Ben-Hadad, said, there is a covenant between you and me, just as there was between my father, who was a wicked, evil king, and your father. Behold, I am sending you silver and gold. Go break your covenant with Baasha, the king of Israel, so that he may withdraw from me. It worked. King of Syria broke his covenant, attacked Israel. Baasha withdrew. Judah was saved. And then the seer came to see Asa. And he asked him, says, because you relied on the king of Syria and did not rely on the Lord your God, the army of the king of Syria has escaped you. Were not the Ethiopians and the Libyans a huge army with very many chariots and horsemen? Yet because you relied on the Lord, he delivered you. He gave them into your hand, but the eyes of the Lord run to and fro throughout the whole earth to give strong support to those whose heart is blameless. Toward him, you have done foolishly in this. From now on, you will have wars. I want you to understand what happened to Asa. When Asa was young, he put his trust and confidence in the Lord. As he became wealthy, as he became powerful, as he was successful, he grew bigger in his own eyes, and God grew smaller. And then when somebody bigger than him came against him, Asa no longer trusted in God. What do we do with wealth and success and power? We must not let our God get smaller because of it. Instead, our God must get bigger because of it. How big is your God? He's not big enough, but he should be getting bigger. All the time. We have not yet talked about the biggest danger of all. The reason why we need such a big God. And that is because of my sin and your sin. All these other things we've talked about, the virus, the opposition to trying to serve the Lord, the opposition to trying to appoint elders, the opposition to try to bring others to Christ. None of those things mean a thing compared to my sin. I need the biggest God of all for my sin. You need the biggest God of all for your sin. Jesus told the Jews who had believed in him in John chapter 8, the one who has sinned has become a slave to sin. But he told them, said, if you abide in my word, you will know the truth, and the truth will make you free. The truth is, God's power, God's word, is the only thing that can deliver us from our sin. If you need that deliverance, if you need that big God,